Hey, it's Tia Carrere, and you're listening to Kino Kingdom with Britt and Rupert. Party on, guys.
If you think about the fees we have to pay to Podbean, we actually lose money. I don't know if that's
Actually, anyone who's listened to this is stealing money from us.
Yeah, it's almost like every time you listen to a single episode of a podcast, it's like if you see us walking down the street and you stop and boot our children in the face.
Pretty much. I mean, it's a direct equivalent. Yes.
Yeah. We're losing so much money. I went to Bradford
Food Bank.
I went to Bradford Bingley's the other day and went in and I said, oh, how much money is in my bank account? And the bank manager looked at me and said, wank account more like, mate. And then I realised, Faye was shaking my hand going, darling, and my eyes rolled back from my head. And she said, Bradford and Bingley's is a building society, not a bank. And they have...
For a start, the bank manager in there, he was clearly an imposter. Idiot.
No, imagine if you knew someone so well that you could walk up to them when they were having like a vision and you would know what they were saying. Oh, you're having this vision about Bradford and Bingley's again.
Yeah.
Such a tedious vision to have. So,
yeah. The manager in there have the incorrect occupation.
It's so crap if you went to a medium and they were there and they had the crystal ball and then she was like, at some point you're going to open a business account. Okay. So the kind of hints at something I'll do in the future, but it's not really concrete, is it? It's not.
No.
Like, I could be doing that for a mate, couldn't I?
And yet more believable than most of the shit they come out with. So, yeah, I'd probably take it on board.
What, falling asleep squatting?
No. Are we now then? So yes, so okay, so dead grandfather, where do we get to? Spirits of the Dead. Oh, so was it true? Had he ever worn a hat in his entire life?
Well, yes, he wore a hat. He wore a hat in the summer when it was, but my point is that it reminded me of that whole thing. As I was relaying that story about my grandfather and families visiting a medium and just being kind of happy with any sort of semblance of if supposed contact, it's still more believable than some. Remember when I was that phase of watching those like ghost shows where they would set up like hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of equipment and then someone would hear like a twig snap. They'd be like, well, that's the devil. That was the devil. That was instantly straight to that conclusion. And everyone else would be like, yep, with you on that. But I watched the other day, I was going through Prime. And it was like, oh, you know, you might be interested in this. And I thought, bloody ghost shows. But then I thought, I could be due another couple, actually. But yeah, so welcome to I'm sorry for the, if there was any sound issues, audio issues in the first couple of minutes. I'm Britt and the other person who isn't talking at the moment is Rupert. This is Kino Kingdom 85. We are the men who talk, but because we haven't done a podcast for 6 weeks, as someone rightly pointed out earlier on, we are now the men who really talk. That really tickled me.
My first question is it 85 or is it 84? This is something which we should probably clear up.
Let me go. This happened to me earlier on. Faye was claiming the same thing, and I was like, no, but let me go on. No, because if you go on Spotify, it's Kino Kingdom 84, stabbed to death in a Ford Cortina Mark III 2000 GXL. So yeah,
right. Okay. Yeah. So corrected.
Don't try and trick me with your math. So a few things obviously before we go into the film reviews. Carl Weathers obviously passed away this last month, which is a real shame. He was one of those people that I see him in the same way as I see Michael Biehn, in that I wish they were in more films I'd seen, or you know what I mean? Yes. I wish they had bigger careers so I could... When you think about Carl Weathers, you've obviously got like Rocky and Predator, the two big ones, and Happy Gilmore, obviously. He's fantastic in that. Yeah. but I unless they're bypassing me, or he was in like dramas or lean more towards TV on the Savalas, which obviously I feel like, oh, I can't... Apart from those films, there's nothing I can really get my teeth into. I'm like, I love him to bits.
But they're so yeah, I mean, they are so iconic, those roles, though, is that... Yeah, it almost doesn't need it. It kind of like Michael Biehn. Like, I mean, Hicks. Sorry, that was a genuine accident. Oh, I wasn't quoting the film. But Hicks is like, he doesn't really say a lot or do a lot as such, but he is iconic in that movie. So I don't know. And of course, there's a rubbish film I watched the other week with Demi Moore. Which I can't even remember the name of, is that average. But, you know, he's always interesting in these movies. And, of course, you know, another iconic character, he was in Terminator. So there's that. But anyway, let's talk about Carl Weathers. Do we know how he died? Did he push too many pencils, or what happened there?
He pushed a pencil over a cliff and followed it. No, I don't know. I honestly don't know, because he died and he was, you know, he seemed to be an acceptable age. It wasn't like he was, yeah, mid-70s, but that's nothing. That's you know, that's only a bagatelle, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that saying means. I just assumed, you know, when someone's in their 80s, you're like, okay, you know, Mother Nature will. But he was a fit man in his, you know, in his early 70s, I guess. And it just a real shame, really. I don't actually know where he passed away, but I'm it's a shame as well that I thought you being the filmite, would sort of say, oh, you could check this and this out. But you're the same as me. You just know him from these sort of seminal roles. And then there's nothing that pops to mind beyond. Oh, that's a real shame. That is a shame.
Yeah, I don't think he was in an awful lot of movies, to be honest. I don't think he was particularly prolific. I mean, I'm sure he was in a lot of TV shows. But let's find out how he died, shall we?
Yay!
Cardiovascular disease. There you go.
Oh, right. Okay. That's quite broad, isn't it? That's.
It is.
Well, anyway. Bless him. Yeah, but Carl, we love you. We wish we could talk about more of your roles, but obviously, like you say, they were such key, memorable roles, especially the people of our generation. That, you know, they are films that will live on for a very, very long time. And he had been to a gymnasium at some point. I'll tell you that.
He had, didn't he? Yeah, he did. That was a man who did not have buttered pancakes for breakfast.
Yeah. I also, over this period, because there's a few things to cover, a few sort of extraneous things that I've made notes of over the last 6 weeks. By the way, the reason we're not slowing down, it just seemed to be constant illness on both sides and just busyness, but we're going to get back into the groove now. I was tempted to make this like a 3 or 4 hour just to make up for it, but it's you know, you got to keep them tight and right. I was looking on YouTube the other day. I don't know if you've heard of YouTube, but it's like an online sort of streaming service where anyone's
like a little Vimeo or something.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Daily Motion. These things called, I forget the name of the channel. I should credit them. You'll probably know what they are. Right. I don't know if it's like Vice or GQ or something, but they're called
Vice and GQ. Things, yes.
Icon interviews.
Right.
So it's like people talking about their, you know, the most iconic roles.
I've seen that. Like where they go through like, basically just chronologically their roles and just talk about them.
Just talk about them for a few minutes. I really like them because they're quite snappy. But the two I want to talk about briefly are Sam Rockwell, right? I watched his because I like Sam Rockwell a lot. Like Moon is an absolutely fantastic film. Mute, not so much. And like whenever he rocks up in something, I'm genuinely like excited to see him. And he's kind of like Philip Seymour Hoffman, where he often just kind of steals the show a little bit.
Yes.
Like Matchstick Men. Sam Rockwell, the Icon interview. I, I could not believe, well, one, how much of a good dancer he is. Because I watched it. Apparently, he dances every time he goes on like the Jimmy Kimmel Show or something. And he's just a really dancer. Yeah, he's like a really smooth dancer. If you type in Sam Rockwell dancing on YouTube, again, not Dailymotion or Vimeo, or Friends Reunited. And it's just like a 2-minute clip of him just like dancing onto the set. It's just brilliant. The other thing is, he is incredibly gracious. I realized when he was talking about the interviews and, like, you know, his iconic roles, a 20-minute, like, sort of, you know, interview based on his achievements, and he could not stop. Just, and it was really subtle as well, just a natural, just talking about everyone else. And you realize he's not talking about himself at any point. He's just sort of instantly switches the focus, the lens on like the achievement of like the cast and crew as a whole. And I just thought, oh, you just seem like a really lovely, gracious, humble man. And it just made me fancy him even more. You're going to say no, but he's not old enough to be in the bar, is he?
He's not old enough to be in the bar quite yet. No. And I mean, I don't think he's not really a strapping hunk of the we usually invite. He's more kind of like you just want to sit down. You'd spend the evening with him and have a good laugh. But I think it'd be platonic.
Yeah. A platonic laugh. My favorite Dream Theater album, by the way. Only released on live cassette, obviously. So that's definitely worth a watch. And the other one I watched was, and it was for, I enjoyed it for sort of slightly different reasons, because of one key line is Kurt Russell, who is, if I were to describe Sam Rockwell as incredibly gracious, I would describe Kurt Russell as incredibly infectious. His laugh and his...
Yeah.
Almost palpable joy at life itself just shines through in every interview I've ever seen with him. But so he's talking about, obviously, for some reason he skips over Jack Burton. I don't know why they didn't ask him about Jack Burton.
Right.
But this one line he delivers that really tickled me, or not a line he delivers, it's something he said. He's talking about Tombstone. And he's saying how, you know, how the crew and how sort of how much he's proud of the film and stuff. And he's talking away and he said, you know, one of my favorite things the director did is a scene in the film where we just look up at the sky and clap. And I thought, that's not the scene that springs to mind for me, Kurt. And then he sort of elaborated and said, you know, because, you know, back in those days, that was their entertainment. They would just look up at the full moon and clap. I thought, fucking hell, they must have been bored. Imagine that. He's like, put your book down, Timmy. Come in the garden. We're going to look at the sky and fucking clap. I'll stay in your dead, actually, I think. I see him play with my stones and somehow coated in poison.
Why are they clapping at the moon? I mean, it's quite a standard sight, I would have thought, out on the prairie, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Apparently, if you watch the Kurt Russell icon interview, and he's like, oh, they would look up and they would like clap at the moon. That was their entertainment. Okay. I thought, not for a long time, though. They went out there for like 4 hours clapping. Were they, better pack it. I'm having too much fun.
Back in the frontier days, it probably would have. Well, the only other entertainment they'd have was watching their children die of dysentery, I suppose. So, yeah, there wasn't much else.
Well, someone's been playing the Oregon Trail on the Acorn Apple Tree. They just re-released that.
Still not as scary as Granny's Garden.
Yes, which I also played the other day. Genuinely terrifying. But yeah, I just thought that's. Can you imagine? So you would have what you would have heard if you were in the bushes in like a sort of a prairie town, right? And you would just see like there'd be probably like loads of couples on their porches in the darkness with the moon above them and like the. The whistle of the wind and the whoo whoo out, and there would be like the creaking of a chair, and there were like the and then the sort of clacking of knitting needles, and then the occasional just sigh of everyone saying, "Fucking hell, I'm bored. I can't wait for the tavas to be invented." So yes, it just tickled me looking up and clapping. That was their entertainment.
Oh my god, if they referred to like a future invention of Savalas as well, someone, an unborn actor.
What's a Savalas? Well, it's a sort of, I'm using a sort of colloquial slang term for a sort of electrical invention, but I'm referring to it through the prism of an actor's name that hasn't been born yet. And like, oh, okay, do you want to come outside and look at the moon? And the other thing that I think you pointed out to me that I realized over the last 6 weeks, it's been a real learning curve for me, is that the International Movie Database, IMDb, was actually born in Cardiff.
I know.
I did not know that. Yeah.
Cardiff University, wasn't it?
Yeah. I just thought that was quite cool because the world's a big place. You know, you've got Gilbert Gork, it could have been Cliddach, it could have been Merthyr Tydfil, it could have been Istanbul. But no, it was Cardiff.
Wow. Yes, yeah, it's true. I'm assuming it was sold for a pretty penny at some point. I think Amazon owned it now.
Oh, really?
I believe so.
That's true.
They must have made a tenner at least on that.
You probably see. Well, you know, obviously not, because they've had to put adverts in my movies, haven't they? So they haven't made that much money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. You probably never see any Netflix shows advertised on IMDb these days. It's probably just a few primers. So that I thought was a nice little bit of trivia. And another thing is, Waxy O'Connor, our regular listener, said Philip K. Dick adaptations.
Right.
Is this the best hit rate for an author in terms of movie adaptations? And I thought it was a really, really good question.
In terms of any author.
Any author. You think about, I mean, Stephen King, right? We could talk about him for a long time, and we would struggle in terms of a hit rate. Like, if we could get three or four of the biggest authors that have had the most movie adaptations and then kind of go through them and say review movies out of like 5 stars, I reckon if you think about Philip K. Dick, you've got Minority Report, A Scanner Darkly, And many others that are completely... I should have prepped this. I should really just type in Philip K. Dick movie adaptations, shouldn't I? But let's do that now.
The Adjustment Bureau.
Yeah, Adjustment Bureau. Total Recall. Total Recall, yeah.
Blade Runner, obviously.
There's a few here from the... Christ, some of these are from the 50s. And I'm going, what?
What?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm looking at the wrong list too. Yes, you got... Oh, my God. Screamers was one of his. That's one of my favorite 90s films now. Yeah, so I need to watch that again. So Screamers.
What was the name of that TV show that on Prime about the Nazis winning the war?
The Man in the High Castle, yeah.
Yeah, that was him.
Paycheck, The Adjustment Bureau, Next, Minority Report, Total Recall, Blade Runner. Scanner Darkly, it's a pretty good, do you know what I mean? Like, I've only missed a couple out there that I've never heard of, like Confessions, Dune Barjo, Radio Free, Albemuth, and The Crystal Crypt are the only ones I didn't mention them because I've never heard of them. They could be amazing. But
how about the Total Recall TV series?
TV series? I'm just looking at the movies. Savalas isn't listed on this website.
Right, okay. Well, there was a TV series of Total Recall in the 90s.
I just remember when Total Recall the movie came out like 14 years ago, which is crazy to think. And you said to me, you know, in the original Total Recall, Brit, they go to Mars. And I said, yeah. I said, well, in this one, they go to London. I thought, it doesn't have that same kind of, it doesn't have that same sort of all-encompassing, you know, well-traveled action, does it? Going to London.
No. They do drill a hole through the earth, which is absurd. That's a really bad movie. CGI in it as well.
No, I wouldn't believe that at all. And there's a few things here that I might keep because there's been a few things here. There's a feature here that I'll keep for next time because otherwise it'll cut into the movie talking time. So I've had a bit of a, I've gone for a bit of a blunderbuss approach this month because I've watched some pretty different movies, but I know you have watched a certain series of films, Rupert.
I have, although I won't be talking about them today because I haven't finished the series because I've sort of catch up with the previous ones. I've got my award winners to discuss today.
Oh, nice. Okay, so I tell you what then. Well, without further ado, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, I might as well kick off with Dune Part 2 because seeing as that is in the cinemas at the moment, so it might actually inform someone's decision to see it or not. Or will it? We'll find out. So Dune Part 2, as it's intriguingly known, this is set on Arrakis, the desert planet. And the story is about Paul, played by Timothy Chalamet, who is, at the end of the last one, he kind of stuck in the desert, and he had a duel with one of the Fremen, just really just Freemen. So I'm just going to call them Freemen. And this sort of like pariah tribe on the desert. So yeah, it's about him proving himself to the Freemen and his subsequent elevation throughout the film to like messiah status. Meanwhile, he falls in love with one of the Fremen, played by Zendaya. But the pressure of being, you know, the second coming does take on their relationship. Meanwhile, Paul's mum becomes a so-called revered mother who has full-on conversations with her unborn fetus. And this revered mother, she essentially becomes like a prophet. Like, and this is where I got a bit suspicious about like this whole thing, right? So basically, she becomes a prophet and she goes around telling all these like poor people in the desert, my son is like the second coming and he's like, he's really important and he's messiah and stuff. It's like, well, this is a convenient arrangement, isn't it? Like Paul's mum suddenly becoming this prophet and insisting that her son should be unconditionally worshipped. I think I'd be citing some conflicts of interest here. Anyway, you've got all the bald guys who are trying to wipe out, including Dave Bautista and Stellan Skarsgård, who's the really fat one. You've got these bald guys trying to wipe out the Freemen with artillery, like when they tried to bomb Bin Laden out of his cave in Afghanistan, that kind of thing. Right. And then finally, you've got this ruling family led by Christopher Walken, where all the women seem to wear scale models of the Tower of London on their heads. It's rather odd. But so that's the kind of setup. And there are melee battles in the desert. There's massive explosions. There's funky jetpacks. And there's lots of very cool sandworm surfing sequences. These huge sandworms that like swim through the sand. When I watched Dune, I feel like I understand what it's like to be a non-Tolkien fan watching the Middle Earth films. Like, I get a sense of being impressed, but also a little bit bored and confused. And I think Dune is slightly less accessible than Tolkien, maybe, because I think Tolkien's genius was the perspective of having the hobbits being these kind of everyman characters who were as like disempowered as a reader. And you don't really get everyman characters in Dune. Like, the only common folk we see in Dune 2 are like these mewling, prostrate background fodder just swarming to worship this new messiah. And and it feels like a kind of almost, it's like everyone is mighty in their own way. They're very archetypical, and it's not really a criticism of the film as such. It's just indicative of the level we're working at here, like big and mythic. And so you can't really find anything particularly relatable or grounded in the characterization. And I sort of kind of like that, because I think, how crazy is it that like Denis Villeneuve, that he was given the money to make this completely bonkers film, but also that he's got such a massive audience. Like, this is, it's not like joyous at all. It's like a very post superhero. It's anti-whimsy, if you like. And I'm kind of glad it exists, because it is very cinematic, but I found it more admirable than enjoyable, I'd say. Because to me, just like, you know, Lord of the Rings must be a load of people walking in smocks. Like, to me, this is just a load of people squatting on sand dunes, frowning, really. So, but saying that, even at 2.5 hours, it feels kind of a bridge. Like, Rebecca Ferguson is the revered mother character, and her transition from just regular strong mum to revered mother, it's basically instant. She says she needs to target the weak, and in the next scene, she has an army of followers. I think the most interesting character is actually Paul himself, which is always good when the protagonist is the most interesting. He's sort of going from privileged royalty to actual messiah. It all goes very Last Temptation of Christ. It's not as good as Last Temptation of Christ, but there you go. I also enjoyed Javier Bardem as this Freeman chief, because he's just utterly besotted with Paul, and he keeps like rationalizing everything Paul does as part of some bigger plan. Like whatever he does, even if it's just like not what the prophecy says, he's just making excuses for him and saying, oh no, you know, he's so powerful, he's just changed the prophecy. So it's, he does provide much needed levity. Some battle scenes, nicely shot, nicely edited, and in the end there are some really big stakes, so that was good. I thought it was better than the first one. Characters are well established now, and it does ramp up very dramatically, but oof, yeah, you definitely need to have seen the first movie.
Is everyone this sort of, like you said, this earthy, well, sandy more than earthy fantasy, yeah, with a distinct lack of whimsy, but yet you know, about prophesizing and mm-hmm. destiny and all this sort of stuff.
Heavy stuff.
Yeah, I know, but yet they're all in this, is it like an alternate, like a distant galaxy? They're called like Paul, are they? And what is mum Dennis, guessing and his father is Pauline Quirk?
I'm guessing it's sort of like a biblical reference, maybe, because I mean it's a very biblical type movie, really. And he is just walking around and like everyone's being told, look, this guy is the second coming or the first coming. I don't know, because I'm not even sure whether this is meant to be like, I guess it's a galaxy far, far away, that type of thing.
Okay.
I don't think it's meant to be like, I don't know, like just, you know, the next star system across. So yeah, it's pretty full on, but yeah, unbelievable to look at, definitely.
I remember you saying a similar sort of thing to the first
one. It's grim, and there isn't much scope for, you know, like in a lot of fantasy, you get like different kind of like locations. So you might have mountains and forests and stuff like that. Not really that much scope for that in Dune, because it is literally just a load of sand dunes and some pretty ugly like industrial towns dotted around the place.
If the sequel was called Do, and instead it was just a load of like constantly slightly damp foliage and like ankle high grass, and it was just 2.5 hours of people complaining about having trench foot and their socks getting wet.
After watching this movie, a yearning for a bit of moist flora.
Is the lack of water a plot point at all then? Or
no, actually, thinking about it, I don't know, maybe they did mention it at some point. They seem to wear these things up their nose a lot, like almost like breathing tubes, but I don't know what they're for. Maybe I missed that in the first movie.
Oh, fair enough.
Josh Brolin's in it as well. He's always good to see.
Yeah, he's in the bar. If they turn around and like that sort of nasal tube is just attached to a backpack, and Paul lifts up his hair and it's just a sideways Yazoo banana milkshake, and he's like, "This is out. We don't need water, mate."
Just a tiny jar of potpourri. That's lovely. That is a bit of lavender in there.
I don't think I'll ever watch these films. These sort of sweeping epics, they never really pull to me. I just don't. I'm sure I would enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's so overwhelmingly epic. Like, that's what I mean. There's nothing to ground it. There are no hobbits here. It is just purely like very, yeah, grandstanding, very epic, mythic stuff. But more interesting, I suppose, you know, in a way, sort of like the way that superheroes have become kind of godly in the culture, then I think it's quite nice to see something like this where people are fallible again, but the themes are mythic. So that's what I mean kind of by post-superhero. I liked it. And I think if you like the first one, you definitely like this one. But I don't think you like the first one or the second one, to be honest.
Well, me personally.
Yes, you personally. Yeah.
Are there more parts, or is this like, I know they're based on original books, aren't they? So
the third part, yes, that is being made. And this trilogy is just purely based on the first book. So there isn't, you know, there are further books to go. So I mean, it'd be pretty amazing if he can achieve like the full series. That would be pretty crazy, because you can see, I mean, it's being obviously his opus, and like I said, I'm just happy that studio, who is it, I'm just going to say Warner Brothers, whoever, they are willing to throw this much money at this film, and I think it's done very well. Like, the first one did pretty well enough to obviously to get a sequel, but the fact that they went for it, it didn't need to make a billion or whatever, then good. And by the way, I mean, this probably cost less than most superhero films, and yet it looks a million times better than any superhero film you've ever seen.
Even Albert Pien's Captain America.
A director could put money on the screen later.
I'm going to do kind of a half review now. Well, it's not even that. About a month ago, I sat down and Faye and I put on an Asian horror film about game developers. I think it was Japanese. And we watched about 45 minutes of it and then sort of said, we'll finish this tomorrow. But I just couldn't find it the next day on any of our logins, on any of the sort of streaming services. I'm sure we watched it on Prime. Yeah, I don't know what happened. but it was. I just wanted just one point. There was a sequence in it, and I was thinking, this doesn't make sense, does it? If you imagine, there's a load of Japanese students, and they're making a VR horror game, right, where, you know, you're looking through your phone, like an alternate, what's it called, augmented reality kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's the main developer, who is a female developer. There's a scene where they say, we're going to do a playtest. And they do the playtest to make sure the game's working properly, and they're in this sort of abandoned building.
Right.
And the way she's reacting is like it's really happening. But what she can see, the people who are also involved in the game are what can see as well. And they're like, she's like really terrified of everything. And they're like, this is just, they're kind of reacting as if it's real as well. And I thought, wow. But this is the game, though. You know, this is the game you're designing. And just because it's scary to us and there's lots of jump scares, she would know when these jump scares are. Because they make out that, like, they've been doing this for a while.
Mm.
And it's really bizarre. Like, they start panicking, telling her to calm down and stuff. And she's really reacting to it. And it just doesn't make sense because she's a playtester. So,
sounds like a failure of internal logic here.
Yeah, and I just thought, and that's when we were like tired. And I said, I'll watch this tomorrow, or whatever. And then I just couldn't find it again. So, if anyone knows,
probably the creepiest thing about the film.
Yeah, the fact that I have no idea what it is. But yes, if anyone wants to let me know at the men who talk at outlook.com what film I watched half of, that would be great. And so, yeah, just leading on from that one, just another two-minute trashing. I, as you know, I really like werewolf films. So I went online, and there was one called Wolf Manor. And the problem started when I looked at the cover on IMDb, as the film was like sort of going through the many production companies involved. On the cover, it's a werewolf sort of in profile, and it says Wolf Manor. And there's an unattributed quote, and it just says, "Blood and gore will always sell." And I reckon the director and producers found out that that's not true in this case when this film was made.
That doesn't really sound like a review anyway. That just sounds like some guidance from a producer.
It's literally, it's the only quote splashed across the cover, like it's the tagline. So the film starts off and you've got, it's a journalist from Fangoria magazine and, I think it's a producer of the movie, and they're arriving, and it's very reminiscent of the start of American Werewolf in London, where they're in this sort of misty town, you know, out in the sticks a little bit, and there's like just a pub and a couple of houses, and they go in the pub, and everyone stops talking the moment they walk in and turn around and look at them, and they say, "Oh, we're looking for this." We're looking for Wolf Manor, and we're making a film, a vampire film there, and we're here to sort of do a puff piece on it or whatever. And the landlord's like, "Oh yeah, that, you know, that we won't go up to Wolf Manor." And he says, "If you go to Wolf Manor, you'll need this." And he opens this box and he starts taking out like sort of Like trinkets with obvious, like he pulls out like a cross, and then he pulls out a load of garlic, and he's like staring them, putting it to one side from the stone box, and then he pulls out like a rabbit's foot, and he's pulling all these sort of mythical sort of items, and then at the bottom of it, he pulls out a torch and just gives it to them and says, "Oh, you need that to get up the road." And I thought, "Oh, okay, this could kind of work," but they fucked up their own joke, because when he was pulling all these things out, it was so poorly filmed that you, and it was cutting back and forth between the expressions that you couldn't really, it was kind of slightly out of shot. So it was like, oh, that wasn't very well done, but it could have been like a sort of half decent joke. But the problem is the film just instantly loses its way. The moment they get to Wolf Manor and someone gets killed, clearly torn apart by like a beast, if you will, it just starts going to this really silly knockabout comedy with like the guy who plays like a sort of vampire who's like an old sort of jaded alcoholic, lovey darling actor, is saying, spends the whole film walking around saying, "Oh, you know, I'm too good for this. I shouldn't be doing this." And the crew basically calling a wanker behind his back. And it's so cheaply filmed that, do you know when you watch really, truly low budget films, when they...
Yes.
When every shot is really zoomed in because they clearly haven't really dressed the set. So it's like, you're like, when people sit down on a couch, it's like just a bare wall behind them and they're talking, or and it's really lazy as well. Like there's a scene in it halfway through where they're running away from, and whenever it shows like that sort of POV werewolf shot where it's like, you know, black and white, and they're sort of chasing them with like a whooshing sound. The werewolf is
never
just
seen
clearly
that before. It's original.
I'll explain it in depth if you want. It's like it's clearly just like a man walking at like walking pace while the other actors just stumble in front of him. And then they finally get to this house and like shut the door behind them. And then one of them just sits on the stairs, and the werewolf just like opens the door and walks in and just kills him. And I thought, you're telling me you ran across an open field from a werewolf screaming and pelting it behind you, stumbling in fear as you did so. And then when you got to a house, you forgot to lock the door behind you. And of course, because it's a low budget film, they can't really damage the house in any way. The wolf is just outside like howling, and they're just like looking at, they can't like smash the windows or whatever. And then there's,
can't break any plates.
Yeah, it can't poke any shit through the letterbox. And then when you see the sort of werewolf, it holds on it for too long, and you can see it's just a dude in a cheap suit. And then when you see the werewolf walking, you realize it's effectively just a man in a hairy suit, and it's got like separate shoes. So you can see that they're like almost like cheap hairy slippers. Ooh. On the feet, and I ended up fast forwarding a fair chunk of this, and it thought, yeah, this is a bad low budget film with like it's cheaply filmed and the actors are irritating, and there's something about people who insert bad comedy like in the term comedy horror is so dangerous. Like if just make it one or the other, it's so hard to balance those two things. And like you said, the reason people do like directors started off with low budget horror is because, you know, as long as you've got like the lighting and like a nice idea, it can go quite far. But when you're relying on acting skills, comic timing, and blending that with another genre, it's like that seems a bit advanced when your budget is 240 quid.
Yeah. A comedy requires a script, really. I mean, a horror movie you can make without a script, can't you, really? You've got a good idea. But comedy, you need a script for that. Do you have any admiration for the fact that they do show the wolf in all its glory? Like, because you know what can sometimes happen is they just don't show anything at all for the entire film.
Yeah, I mean, there's a distinct lack, from what I can remember, of CG. So it is just quite practical. And it looked cool, but then it's not enough for the film, you know. Like and you see it so often, and because of how because the setups and the attacks are so kind of poorly done. Just looking at it, thinking, oh, actually, in profile, torso to head, it's quite cool. It's not enough for the like hour and 20 minute runtime.
Right.
So. Yeah, and it's got an ending that hints at a sequel, and you're like, fuck it, I don't know what you were thinking when you filmed that. So, Yeah, it just a Wolf Mayonnaise. Look, I'd love to say it was a bit of a hidden gem, but it's not good.
Okay. Where is it available? Is it on Prime? There's a Prime, isn't it?
It is on Prime.
Of course it is. Okay. Just a quick disclaimer about, I mean, I know I said that my list was full of award winners. Well, they were all nominated for Academy Awards, but none of them actually won any. I'm sure they've won other awards. So the next one on the list is Naiad. Have I talked about this already? Because it's been so long since our previous episode. Wow.
How do you what NYAD?
NYAD on Netflix. So this is the story based on a true story drama about Diana Naiad, whose life ambition was to swim 100 miles from Cuba to Florida. Shark and jellyfish infested waters, pretty rough. So she tried in 70s at age 28, and then age 60 around 2010 she decided to have another go, and that is the story that's told here. Annette Bening plays Diana Naiad, and her best friend is played by Jodie Foster. It's directed by Elizabeth Chai Vasahelyi and Jimmy Chin, and they are the husband and wife team who directed the terrifying Free Solo documentary, which I mentioned before.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah.
Yes, but this is obviously not a documentary. This is fiction. But yes, Diana Naiad is quite a character. She has this deep voice, which is almost robotic in tone, but she also has this brutal honesty in it. She has a very infectious spirit, and you can see how she would convince a team of professionals to follow her ridiculous dream for no money. It is a bit disappointing to read afterwards that there is some controversy about her achievements, and this movie is based on Diana's 2015 memoir, so it's clearly from a certain perspective. But you know, I'm not the Guinness Book of Records record that was, I think it was rescinded, but I'm not sure it really matters anyway, because it's more of a film about friendship and teamwork and this aging lady's almost insane single-mindedness to like swim 100 miles with sharks. To its credit, it never resorts to tiresome tropes about the limits of the elderly body, and it positions it more as like the ultimate test of the human body, not just an old human body. And you know, there's a simplistic assumption that what she's doing is impossible, regardless of how old a person is or young a person is. And the whole message of never giving up in a dream, anything is achievable, etc., it's laudable on paper, but, you know, it's nice to think about. But in practicality, really, not everyone has the access and the sorts of resources that she does to realize their most outlandish life goals. So that's a bit fanciful, but yes, there's some pretty clunky and cheesy flashback sequences that could have been cut down or exercised completely. They don't really clarify why Diana is the way she is. They just seem to be more about inciting sympathy for someone who's a bit of a belligerent asshole in adulthood. But there's amazing performances from Annette Bening and Jodie Foster, both nominated the Oscars. I know when someone says a performance is electrifying and it gets bandied about a bit, but I really do feel that when Jodie Foster is like delivering a monologue, she's so like detailed and her performance is so good. And it's weird, it's like she's almost, I'm a big fan of Contact, as you know, but she's almost like standing opposite her character in Contact here, like in Contact. Like she plays the ridiculously single-minded, hell-bent woman who will give up at nothing. But here she's like standing alongside that person. So it's quite a different character. It's interesting. It's all preamble, building up to the final attempt, by which point you are really rooting for her to complete the journey. And unlike another film I will discuss tonight, the build-up is worth it, and the finale does deliver. And it's very much a rousing crowd-pleaser type film. somewhat neutered by a cursory read of Wikipedia, but no less powerful in the moment, I would say. And it is formulaic, but it's elevated by two pretty much perfect performances and excellent chemistry between them. So I think it's mildly recommended, Naiad on Netflix.
Okay. Again, sounds cool. I'm sure some listeners will love that, but it's not one I'm going to flock to.
Yeah.
I flock to stuff like The Lost City, not that one, or that one, or that one, or that one, or that one. because originally apparently called The Lost City of Z, but then changed. This is a film directed by Aaron and Adam Nee, starring Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum and Daniel Radcliffe. Sandra Bullock stars as a widow. Yeah, widow. Widow who is an author of adventure novels, starring a character called Dash McMahon. And she is also supposedly like an amateur. I don't know, what's the term for someone who can speak sort of ancient languages, you know, and sort of crack.
Like a linguist?
A linguist of sort of like dead languages, that kind of thing. And she's but it was her husband, but she obviously had a bit of a dabble with it as well. But he's passed away. And she's become sort of disillusioned with these books. She's a very lonely person, incredibly, incredibly wealthy. There's a scene in the start of this film where she's just shows her like drinking wine in the bath and like writing, and it's all very sort of solitary. And then it cuts to her like making a meal for herself, and the amount of food she's preparing is preposterous. And I thought surely someone would have said, and bearing in mind how rake thin she is, it's like she wouldn't chop up like a full bowl of carrots or like nine tomatoes. Like, why would that be happening? Anyway, so she's got this sort of lonely life, and she's really disillusioned. And the film begins with her and Channing Tatum as Dash McMahon, and it becomes clear that the fans love his character more than the books or her as an author. They just want sort of more of him, and she just wants to kill him off and write sort of proper books, but the fans and her publishers won't let it happen. And she gets kidnapped by Daniel Radcliffe, who's someone called Fairfax, who is an incredibly rich billionaire who wants to find this fabled lost city and this incredible treasure. And he feels like he needs Sandra Bullock because only she, through sort of maintaining her husband's knowledge, can supposedly crack the codes and find the path. And Channing Tatum's character is obsessed with Sandra Bullock, so he goes on this quest with Brad Pitt to rescue her. And that's kind of the main thrust of the narrative. Brad Pitt is brilliant in this film. He plays this kind of preposterously, like, sort of faux humble, just like incredibly sort of effective, adventurous sort of thing. And Channing Tatum has done what Channing Tatum has done for a bit too much in my eyes, and like this kind of like lovable, meaty goofball who is like like thick as pig shit, but is a sort of a heart of gold. And they go on they're going through these sort of jungles and so on. And the film, I could feel it losing me, because Brad Pitt's character is amazing, but he's not a major character throughout it. It's mostly focused on Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. And I don't know how much of this was filmed on location, but the use of green screen is overwhelming. Like, everywhere they go, it's just nothing looks real. It's so bright and vivid, and it's so off-putting. And
like, are we talking about places where they literally could have gone, but they chose not to, and they just did it in front of green screen? So lazy.
It just doesn't look real anywhere. Okay. If they were there, if on IMDb it says it was actually filmed on location and no green screen was used, it's filmed in a really distracting way where everything is like really vivid and bright and sparkly, and it just really a very like unreal sense to everything.
So a combination of green screen and hideous digital photography.
Yeah. And the main film is basically them in a jungle bickering, right? And she is a widow, and she obviously loves her husband, and she is a really reserved, emotionally distant, sort of, and academically intelligent, right?
Yep.
And he is just basically a thick as shit hunk. And the disdain she has for him throughout the whole film, through the first half, is like, you think, yeah, I can see why you wouldn't get on, and like he needs to really move on from just fancying you, basically. And I shit you not, the turning point in the film where she thinks, ah, maybe we could work, maybe there is something more to him that I've missed, is coincidentally the exact moment she finds out that he's got a nice big cock. And it's just a scene where they're like covered in leeches and she just sees his cock and she's like, wow. And from that moment on, she's kind of has a different view of him. And I thought, oh, Jesus. Right. Interesting. And the whole, so that relationship is totally unbelievable. There are funny moments in it. There's a moment at the start where, when it becomes clear that she's gone missing, outside her hotel, and her publisher's gone bonkers, but there's sort of like an admin girl there. And she says, I wouldn't worry about it too much because when I was in college, one of my friends went missing and we found her. She was dead in her car, but we found her. and then, so that was quite funny, but they're too few and far between. Right. And you're kind of spoilt with Brad Pitt because he's so ridiculous. He's kind of like a Jason Statham character in I Spy, whatever it's called.
It's obviously the best thing about it.
Yeah, obviously the best thing about it. And he's not running throughout the whole thing. And this... I don't want to offend anyone when I say this. I generally don't want to be. This is the best way I can describe this. Sandra Bullock has had Michael Burke, Clive Dunn, right? But there's a scene in this where she's eating, and she looks like a monkey. She's leaning on the bonnet of a car, talking to China, and she's eating. And because she's had so much Botox and so much work done, her mouth is moving, but nothing else on her face is. And you know how monkeys and apes look when they eat, where like they're kind of dead-eyed, but their mouth is moving.
But their mouth's been crazy. Oh my God.
I thought, you can't, you've had so much work done now that you can't move your face. And now you can't eat on screen ever again because it draws attention to it, because it's only, you realize how much movement there should be in your visage and there is not. So it was like the fact that was something that I remembered, and I didn't watch the film thinking, oh good, I'll make fun of Sandra Bullock for slowly turning into Michael Jackson. It was just unavoidable.
I was going to ask how much he looks like Michael Jackson in the film.
The fact that we're having this conversation isn't a good sign, is it? But not as much as she did in the Heat, I'll tell you that. But yeah, so if this was a film, this kind of a film you can imagine you would watch with a partner for like a bit of light entertainment. But there was enough parts in it to get on my nerves to make me think, I don't really, I'm not really with this. It's not for me. This isn't a film for me.
It looks like it's a film for, which is specifically designed to be watched by those who can't decide what to watch. You know, it's going to be at the top of the, like, it's probably going to be in the top 10 on that. What was it on Netflix?
Yeah.
It's going to be in the top 10. Probably. It's got a couple of actors that you like in it. It's probably got some action, you know, I'll have some romance. It's just, you know, from what you were saying, it sounded like you were describing Romance in the Stone. Then it sounded like you're describing the African Queen, and then I just thought, well, this is, I mean, the fact that it just sounds like other presumably better movies,
yeah,
and they're still wheeling this crap out, no, this is not the film I want to watch. And I bet it costs as much as Dune. The thing about that thing about like stuff looking fake, and it isn't, it's partly to do with digital photography, definitely, because it just, there's something far too pristine about digital photography. There's something that the grain gives you on old film, which distances you and can, but at the same time transports you. Anyway, but it was a problem with, it was something I noticed in, I always cite this example, in Aquaman. Now, obviously, Aquaman, you kind of need the CG for the underwater sequences, but there's a sequence where they go to, I don't know, somewhere, a desert or something like that, right? So, and it's like, clearly, and it's quite a, you know, a significant sequence. And it's like they couldn't be bothered to take him out there or take him to a place which vaguely could have looked like a desert, like near California, maybe, like, yeah. You know. And so they just green screened it and a whole thing. And it, as long as it's so obvious, you know, it's so obvious, you just don't. And it's like, that's just so lazy. You've spent $300 million making this movie. You can't be asked to just fly him out to Nevada or something like that, you know, for a desert sequence.
It's really, I think, like, I'm not, like you, I know, the whole reason that we, not the reason, the reason we do this podcast is because you're the sort of student of film, and I'm a complete layman. But what I enjoy about films, especially when you're looking at like 80s and 90s films, is when you're watching like a New York film, and you know you're going to see gritty New York, it's going to be sort of like, sort of wet streets and steaming manhole covers, and it's there, you know. And when you watch something like Jurassic Park, okay, the dinosaurs aren't real, but you know they're there, they're walking through real, they're like traversing a real landscape. And when that's removed, it just feels so sort of ultra sleek that it's like, this doesn't, there's no earthiness, there's nothing grounded about this film, there's no set. I just feel like everything just feels like a CG set, and yeah, it was really off-putting in this film.
Yeah. It's just lazy. Okay, what was it called again? The Lost City of...
It was called originally, apparently, The Lost City of Z, or Z, but then they changed it to The Lost City. And there's, when I was on Letterboxd, there's about 40 billion films called The Lost City. And this is not the best of them, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
I've got to be fair, though, I still like Channing Tatum, though. I still think he's got good comic timing. It's just this film wasn't... Yeah. So, sorry, Kurt.
Well, I was just going to say I'm sticking with Netflix as well, to talk about a film called Rustin, another awards nominee. So this is on Netflix. Bayard Rustin, I think that's how you pronounce it. He was a compatriot of Martin Luther King. And in 1963, he got this idea in his head to. So 1963, pre-Civil Rights Act, he got the idea in his head to organize the biggest peacetime rally in US history over civil rights for Black Americans. So 100,000 sympathizers marching on Washington, basically. And naturally, there were a variety of blockers in his way, not least racist wankers. But there's also a bit of a political minefield to negotiate, and other interested parties shifting their alliances around him, and the fact that he is totally gay as well. And so Colman Domingo plays Rustin, and there are some familiar faces around him. There's a catastrophically miscast Chris Rock in this film.
I was looking at his name on this cast list, and I thought the last thing I saw him in was Spiral, and he fucked that right up the ass. So
well, I mean, he compared to this, he seemed born for his role in the Saw movie. So he wears, and he plays like, thing is, he's playing like, clearly he's meant to, someone who's meant to be an elderly person. He's the leader of the NAACP. But he's meant to be elderly. But of course, trouble is, Chris Rock is, he's not elderly. And also, he has a very youthful face as well, on top of that. So he,
and quite a like high-pitched, reedy voice.
Yeah.
Does he do like a bit, a skit?
No, because this is serious. Like,
okay.
He has an astonishing hairpiece in this film. There's also a scheming senator, quite a nice cameo from Jeffrey Wright in this. But the problem is with the film, it's unbelievably boring and linear. And Colman Domingo is giving it his best shot. He was nominated for the Oscar, as I said. But none of Rustin's infectious charisma is captured in the like filmmaking form. It's like, it's just really flat lighting. Dull, medium shot, theatrical camera work, really over the top theatrical performances, none of which can match the main actor by any means. And it's no surprise, because the director is someone called George C. Wolfe, whose CV is just packed with theatre productions, and this looks like a theatre production. But, you know, even if it were directed by Steve McQueen, not that one, this would be a total dud. It's got a terrible script, which is at best righteous but cringingly obvious, but at worst it literally sounds like people reading a Wikipedia entry. Like, if they can't find a moment to put the person's name and occupation on the screen, then they'll have a character like a character will be talking to someone and just find a way to say, you're the deputy head of security, damn it, or something like that. It's really ham-fisted exposition.
This is quite a celebrated film, by the way, that you're hacking apart. Yeah,
they're wrong. So, it's got endless hackneyed montage sequences, and to complement that, there's this horrible schmaltzy score as well. And then you've got, finally, the icing on the cake is this thuddingly dull attempt to insert a love triangle into the story, which is always a bad sign. And it just completely knocks the wind out of the urgency of that main narrative, you know, because you've got this story about this, unprecedented event, and it's, you know, time is of the essence, all these political dilemmas and stuff, and negotiations to get through, and which is dramatic enough. And then they just have this completely tedious love triangle subplot, which just totally slows everything down. And it's all building up to this final march, which did take place, but it completely falls flat because they clearly didn't have the budget or the filmmaking skill to achieve it. So they just cut to documentary footage. You see them setting up some like fences and some chairs, and then you just cut to documentary footage. So there's nothing. And of course, it actually went ahead quite calmly, so there wasn't even really any drama there. So yeah, it really sucks. It's a pity because Coleman Domingo's performance is so energetic and committed. He deserved a better script, a better director, a better crew, a better casting director. He just deserved better. So it was a pity. It's an interesting story, but just read it on Wikipedia.
It's just tickling me because actually I'm going to disprove my own sort of theory, but Oscar winners I tend to just sort of move away from naturally for some reason. But that's not true because last year or the year before, whenever it was, I really liked, what was that Korean film?
Parasite.
So, yeah, really love that. Which is obviously an Oscar winner. But the three films you've talked about so far, I'm just thinking no. By the way,
two more. So I'm convinced that one of these I may be able to convince you to watch.
Oh, okay. Maybe. I didn't know. Okay, that's cool. I just didn't know that Time Bomb with Michael Biehn had won an Oscar. Now as well, like they've revisited. Yeah.
Posthumous.
You were talking about
dead, is he? He's not dead, is he? That was Paxton. Hudson, sir. Yeah.
The Lost City, budget 68 to 74 million. Dune Part 2 budget. Oh, where is it? I've gone too far. Dune Part 2 budget, 190 million. So they didn't have similar budgets.
Okay. but still, 190 million, mind. That's significantly less than, any superhero film, pretty much. And it still looks better than any of them. I bet it's cheaper than Aquaman. And that looked like shit.
I should have a look just out of curiosity. What when was Aquaman? I'll just have an Aquaman movie. Aquaman, so that is the 2018 film.
Yeah, we've got 12. I mean, I'm
200 million.
Yeah, and it looked like absolute dog shit. So.
My next film is one that it kind of pains me to say, really. It's Who's Harry Crumb? I was in the mood for an 80s comedy, but maybe one I hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, John Candy, you see him in, you know, Home Alone and Uncle Buck and Cool Runnings and all those sorts of films. And I thought, I haven't actually watched a film that he sort of stars in that I've never played. Trains and Automobiles is probably my favorite. And I watched this, and so have you seen this? Who's Harry Crumb?
No, I haven't.
Right. So he plays. He comes from a long line of these well-respected detectives, and he's obviously the black sheep of the family. And the company, the Crump sort of private detective agency, whatever, has been taken over by problematically Jeffrey Jones. And he is brought in for a case, and it's quite clear that Jeffrey Jones is completely corrupt and is putting him on this case just so he messes it up and he can blame him and sort of finally get him out of the way so he can fully take over the company. And it's kind of like a Beverly Hills Ninja Chris Farley kind of thing, where, you know, he's this sort of big bumbling oaf who's kind of lovable but always falls on his feet. But it's just not funny. I don't know if there are some people out there who would think, oh, no. I really like it. But at every point, every kind of skit or set piece, I was thinking, right, I'll enjoy the next one. You know, like I can't sit here for a full 90 minutes and not laugh at a comedy. But it just never seems to get out of that first gear. There are scenes in it that some may describe as racist, Rupert. Such as when he dresses up as an old Asian man, puts on an accent. Okay. That's not something that would happen now. This Shawnee Smith is in it, who I recognise from when she was in the TV show Becca with Ted Danson, back when I used to watch The Savalas in the mid-2000s.
Tim Thomason's in it as well. And Tim Thomason is like the ultimate, oh, that guy actor. So you're thinking, who's that? And then you look at him and you're like, oh, yeah, that guy.
I honestly thought it was Treat Williams for a too long time.
Most people do.
James Belushi's in this. Jim Belushi is in this. I'm going to say the worst cameo experience I've ever seen, right? There's a scene where John Candy is just on a bus coming back from wherever he was to the office. And James Belushi's just sat next to him reading the paper. And there's no, and this is an example of the kind of, I don't even know, it's not comedy. I think maybe people were supposed to like point at the screen and say, oh, that's James Belushi. And that would like be enough to carry the scene. But it's just James Belushi sat there reading the paper and John Candy's just eating like a Mars. And he says, oh, do you want a bite? And he goes, no, thanks. And then he's drinking a can of Coke. He says, oh, do you want a sip? And he says, oh, no. And then it just cuts to the next scene. And I thought, that's not funny.
It's not a comedy sequence.
It's not a comedy sequence. It's just
John Candy's breakfast, really, isn't it?
A Mars and a can of Coke. Yeah, he eats that before he opens his eyes. I think it's a shame because I was waiting for it to, and it's really sleazy in a way that's like not really a, you know, all 80s comedies had these kind of women living in ridiculous houses where all the artwork is pointy and everything is bloody art deco and they're just stupid tarts. But it, because it's not funny throughout, and it's not funny in like the verbal delivery or in the physical comedy, because the physical comedy is too it's not snappy enough. It's not like it's not like completely ludicrous like Jim Carrey. It's just like a bloke gets a bit of water on himself and it looks like he's peed himself. Or, you know, there's a bit where he like leans. Actually, the funniest part of the film is where he goes into someone's office. And I thought it was bloody. Who was the one who was in that really celebrated Robert? Who's that really celebrated actor from like the 50s and 60s? Robert Mitchum.
Yes.
So I thought it was him, but it's not. He's basically like when Harry Crumb comes in to talk to him and ask him about the disappearance of his daughter, which is the thrust of the plot. Not Robert Mitchum is making fishing hook lines for his fishing rod, and he's got like a desk. You know those mahogany desks with like a green piece of leather.
Yes.
And he's got like fish hooks on them. And then there's a point where Harry Crumb says, listen to me, and turns around and presses his hands clearly on all the fish hooks and his eyes really widen. Yeah. And then not Robert Mitchum goes, you okay, Mr. Crumb? And he's like, yes, yes, yes. And he sort of stands up and looks at them and then sort of like looks really shocked and turns around. But then the joke goes on too far as he's like pulling them out. And then it just stays on him. And I thought, well, that was quite funny, but now it's not funny because you...
Oh, dear.
And it's like the timing.
Do you think they stumbled upon a joke that actually made people laugh? So they thought, oh God, we're gonna have to, let's milk this.
Yeah, but it's not like, for instance, right? Him leaning—I know this is going into the intricacies of it, but like him leaning on it, the eyes widening, the guy looking at his hands and saying, "You're right," and he's like, "Yes, yes, yes, yes." Turns around, looks at his hands, and sort of silently goes, "Ha, ha, ha," funny. But then 20 or 30 extra seconds of him going, "Ah, ah," and pulling them out and dropping them on the floor while the guy just looks at his back.
Yeah, that's not funny, is it?
It's not funny, is it? It's just extending it. So it's stuff like that. It's just like. It'll the next film I'm going to talk about, it had very, very similar problems where it's like the humor, it's written by someone who the humor, it's like there are jokes in it, but they're never delivered properly. Nothing lands, but they're all there. There's probably someone who loves this film, and it's not me, unfortunately.
It makes me think that maybe editing is a crucial part of comedy, yeah. As much as like comic timing and stuff, but like knowing when to cut away. Knowing when not to extend the joke is as important as when to extend the joke. Because I think of like my favorite 80s comedies, and I think of The Money Pit, which is still brilliant. And like in The Money Pit, there's like a scene where obviously there's a famous scene where Tom Hanks sinks into the floor because there's a hole underneath the carpet and he's stuck there. And that is an extended sequence. It's funny because of how long he's there for. And that's you extend that part of the joke, right? Now, when his wife comes home and she finally finds him and she tries to pull him out and he just slips through and falls like, to the floor below, then the joke's over and it stops there. Like what you're describing is equivalent of if that happened, then you've laughed. And then there's a whole sequence about him
being pulled out on the floor for too long. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so you've got an extended joke, then you've got like a sudden stop joke, and it's like, that's it, that's editing, done. But well, it's like, you've got to make it land.
When I was watching it, I was thinking about my favourite sort of pieces of like physical comedy, for example, like with the Pink Panther films, where, like, you know, at the start of A Shot in the Dark, and he just gets out of the taxi and falls straight into a fountain, completely and utterly into a fountain. And when he answers the door, he's just dripping. And then the butler says, "You're wet, sir." And he says, "Yes, yes, there was an issue with the water feature." And then that's it. So you've got, like, a funny physical joke, a funny rebuttal, and that's it. Or when he falls down the stairs and everyone turns around, but then he just stands up and acts like nothing's happening. It's never mentioned again. It's like a second-long joke. But, yeah, you're right. Now that you've said that, it's kind of clear. It's the editing.
Okay. So, okay, that's not a hidden gem. What's it called again?
I would have loved it to be as well. Who's Harry Crumb? It's a film I used to watch... see a lot when I remember worked in a video shop. The cover, the poster is him with like suction cups on a building, and it's just not funny.
They wouldn't hold him. Okay. And that is on Prime?
yes, it was.
I'm still on Netflix. It's all Netflix. I watched a film called Society of the Snow. Which is set in 1972, and a Uruguayan rugby team, this is based on a true story, Uruguayan rugby team was travelling by a small plane to Chile, and it crashed into the remote wilderness of the Andes Mountains, and the survivors...
Is this the Alive thing? Right.
Yeah, it's the same story, yeah. So the survivors spent weeks, months... surviving in the wreckage, eventually resorting to eating the bodies of the dead to stay alive. So it's a real knee slapper, this one. Like you mentioned, yes, it's like 30 years ago Frank Marshall made the slightly schmaltzy Alive, which covered the same story with a bunch of English language actors, including a young Ethan Hawke. This one is directed by J.A. Bayona, who's known for The Impossible, which was also a disaster movie. He's also known for one of the Jurassic World sequels, and also The Rings of Power. So he knows how to put money.
He's also known for being the Spanish, what's his name? What's Anton Deck? What's his name? Anthony McPartlin. He looks like a Spanish.
Really?
Forehead. My God.
Is there a hairline to meet it?
He must have thought, my forehead's not big enough. It's not accentuated enough. I'm going to have to pike my hair as well, I think.
Okay, just to really accentuate it. So this one is all Spanish language, therefore instantly more convincing than the Hollywood version. It's also more sensitively written and more intense and scarier, and has just more of a sense of the sheer isolated horror of the experience. And there is something inherently cinematic about this story, so I can see why people keep coming back to it. Like, there's this juxtaposition between these vast mountain, monolithic mountains, and these great stretches of snowy nothingness. And then you've got this very internal struggle of the survivors. And of course, they're all really young. So you have this unique element of them all having their whole lives there to them. And they're deeply religious as well. They're Catholics, and that is the core of their struggle. Like, it's like saying, is cannibalism the ultimate desecration of the divine human body? Or is it better to make sure you live so you can continue to bring value into the world? So quite a conundrum. I suppose it's about the cost
and then his friend looks up and says, well, that's actually an interesting question, but one that I've already answered myself personally.
Yeah. One of them really holds off. He goes so long, he's like, I really can't. I am famished, though, honestly. I suppose, yes, it's about the cost of hope, I suppose. It asks the question, like, basically, would you eat an ass so you can live to see tomorrow? Which is a crucial question I think we all have to answer. As with Alive, the film doesn't really show the mechanics of eating a human body. Like, we hear descriptions of the process and we see the remains. But yeah, it's not like too minging and disgusting. It's much more about the concept than the mechanics of it. And weirdly, I feel like there's a sequel in this movie, like a story to tell you how the hell you could possibly go on living, what kind of a life you'd leave after having to like eat your best friend's legs, you know. So I need a special mention for an actor in this called Enzo Vogrinich. Anyway, he plays the part of Numa Tocati, and this guy, he seems like a bit of a future star. He's one of the like protagonists here, and there's a bit of Adam Driver about him in terms of like looks and intensity, so I think he's one to look out for. But yes, anyway, overall, better film than Alive, amazing, unique story, but yes, possibly lacking in the knockabout comedy department.
Yeah, that what's his name? Enzo Vogrinich Roldan is kind of a cross between, if people listen to this, go on Wikipedia, Adam Driver and Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
In that picture. Yeah, it's really weird. And not weird, he's a good looking guy, but well, that's good to know. I wonder if he'll crop up in a few. And this is his, what, one, two, three, fourth kind of.
Yeah. He was. I mean, he's got a lot of heavy lifting in this film, but but they all have, really.
Yeah, and he's in a TV show called Porn and Ice Cream as well, if you fancy watching that.
Okay.
I like it's
those things.
At the same time. I watched a bit, 20 minutes before I turned it off and thought, yeah, this isn't for me. Leslie Nielsen in Wrongfully Accused, right?
Okay.
The ripoff of The Fugitive. It's the first thing with it is on Amazon Prime, where I watched this, it was, do you know, we've watched this before where, I don't know if it's just an early DVD transfer or a bad transfer, where you're watching it and there's visible lines across the screen for the whole thing. Is that like where it's like 240p obviously blown up and you can just see the lines?
Yeah, or like literally a videotape transfer, quite possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a poor transfer anyway. But also this, I watched this straight after watching Who's Harry Crumb. I thought, this was like, well, watch this, and I was like, click, whatever. I think I was doing something else. And it came on, and I watched the first 20 minutes of it, and it's just, again, I just thought, this isn't for me, this isn't. It's like, it's someone sitting down in a room with a lot of other people and saying, right, he is, you know, playing a violin and orchestra. What wacky things can happen? What zany things can happen? What quirky things can happen? And it'll be, you know, and they'll be like, oh,
so, I don't like any of these adjectives.
Yes. And it's that. It's that. I'm not going to review it anymore. It's that. That's what happens. And it's just people slipping over, people getting hard-ons, people, you know, suddenly playing a violin and then it turns into a rock solo. It's the laziest, lowest common denominator, obvious jokes constantly at such a pace that nothing lands. And it's just, there's like no subtlety, but it's just not funny. And
I'm guessing this is post Naked Gun.
Oh, this is 1998. This is a ripoff of The Fugitive. So this is,
oh, you'd have to be, yeah. Okay.
5 years too late. So not for me. And it made me think of The Ridiculous Six, where I watched the first 10 minutes of that and thought, whoever's written this film is the antithesis of my kind of humor, so I'm just going to not bother. The writer,
I think I watched all of that.
Of Wrongfully Accused?
No, of Ridiculous The Fugitive? Six. Mm. No, I watched all of The Fugitive.
I couldn't make it past the first 10 minutes. I
don't know why I watched it all. It was terrible.
It's really bad. This film was written, directed and produced by Pat Proft, and when I looked at his filmography, it is unbelievable. He wrote, I'll do it all in one go, right, see if I can do it in one breath: Police Academy, Bachelor Party, Moving Violations, Real Genius, The Naked Gun, From the Files of Police Squad, Lucky Stiff, The Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, Hot Shots, Brain Donors, Hot Shots Part 2, Naked Gun 33.5, The Final Insult, High School High, Mr. Magoo, Wrongfully Accused, Scary Movie 3, Scary Movie 4, Bachelor Party 2, The Last Temptation, Mostly Ghostly, and Scary Movie 5. And out of all those, he directed Wrongfully Accused. That was the only one he directed. So you get the kind of, where is there like moments in Hot Shots that I found funny, and like Police Academy and all that sort of thing? This is the next film after this was Scary Movie 3. So he was out of steam by this point. Like there was no, it was just
throwing. Yeah, and also I think this comes back to what we're kind of saying about editing and directing. Like, he may be able to come up with jokes that could work, but like with Naked Gun, a big part of the success of Naked Gun was the Zucker brothers really understanding how to use Leslie Nielsen in the right way.
Leslie by Nelvin Klein.
Because when you think about that list, like, yeah, I mean, Hot Shots, it wasn't very funny, was it? And I think that's partly because of Charlie Sheen, which is weird because he's a bad actor. And usually bad actors can end up making quite good comic actors. If you think you're like Mark Wahlberg, you know that can happen that way around, because they're too...
By playing it straight, yeah.
Yeah, by playing it straight. Kind of... And just, like, that is the funny thing about it. But no, Hot Shots is no. I he spoiled that as well.
Was it Scary Movie 5? What was that one I watched with Damon Wayans? It was one of the worst films I've ever seen. Anyway, no, it wasn't Damon Wayans. It was Keenan Ivory. There's Damon, Keenan Ivory, and the other one, Marlon. But yeah, this just sent comedy. Like, I mean, you're looking at a time when you wouldn't even have a nostalgia for it, you know? Like, I remember liking this when I was a kid. There's not even that. You're just watching a shit film from the 90s. A bad VHS transfer. So yeah, no, not for me.
It was, that would have been, like, Wrongfully Accused would have been like 5 years after The Last Naked Gun as well. So Leslie would have been really quite old.
72, in fact.
Okay. Probably not as old as I thought he was, to be honest. But anyway, okay. Yeah, won't watch that either then. Okay, excellent. where would someone watch it if they were to?
They would go to Amazon Prime if they wanted to watch that.
Wouldn't they? Okay, let's bring it back to Netflix. And I will... This is my last entry tonight. And it's a film called Maestro, which was nominated for a lot of Oscars and won none of them. It's written, directed, and starring Bradley Cooper. And it's a sprawling biopic about the American conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein. It's set between 1943 and 1987, By the way, the makeup is amazing, so you need to get Faye to watch it just for that. So yes, Bernstein's key works and performances are dotted around the place, but mostly it's about his fractious but also deeply loving relationship with his wife, Felicity Montalegre, played by Carey Mulligan. Now, I know nothing about Leonard Bernstein, but I found this...
I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, I found this really compelling because it's so well made. And I think often actors will turn into solid, worthy, but slightly bland directors, like Clint Eastwood or Angelina Jolie. But I really think Bradley Cooper might be the real deal. It's got this beautiful and also meaningful cinematography where, like, what's in the frame actually means something. There's this really great showdown scene where Leonard and his wife are having a massive argument. And out of the window in the background, there's this, because it's sort of set on the day of a birthday party, like a really wealthy birthday party. And out the window in the background, you just see this parade of sad carnival floats passing by. It's like the joy of their marriage is just sliding away. And there's this unbelievably good scene in Ely Cathedral, apparently. It's where Leonard Bernstein is conducting a piece by Gustav Mahler. And the sheer grandiosity of the music and the energy of the performance by Cooper actually made me rewind the film and watch the scene again because it was so good.
Brilliant.
And it's got excellent chemistry between Carey Mulligan and Bradley Cooper. And what I like about the direction, the editing, is that Cooper isn't content with mere mimicry. He holds onto characters' faces at the end of the scenes, like as if we're watching them actually digest what's just happened. And so it's not just acting with makeup and hair, it's sort of acting with eyes as well. So, but because on the surface it's a bit of a linear biopic, but I like the way it just raises some vaguely original questions along the way. Like, this has this whole thing about duty, the duty and responsibility of the artist to the people, because there's this tension between being a so-called serious composer and delivering what the public really wants, and in delivering that, at what cost to your personal relationships. And Bernstein is presented as this true crowd pleaser insofar as he loved people in a very general way, but he wasn't able to just love his lonely wife. I mean, one of the barriers to that was the fact that he was gay. So,
oh, right.
I don't think he did too badly, considering he managed to, like, sire multiple children. But, yeah, it's not ideal. And I do think the film could be seen as letting him off the hook a bit about his many, many affairs with men. And it's like it comes back to these lines like, oh, he's just so generous with his love, or he had too much love to contain. But, yes. Maybe he's just cheating, but then you do wonder actually if he had come out of the closet in the modern sense, then would he just have been destroyed and never left the same legacy? So basically he was a bit of a shit, but the period in which he lived was shitter. So yes, yeah, I thought this was a very high quality film and a proper piece of meaningful cinema, which does more than simply join the dots of someone's life. So I really like this, Maestro.
You're getting a bit of a twitch on for Bradley Cooper by the sounds of things, then.
I am. Well, I mean, what was this last movie? It was A Star Is Born, which I thought was hot trash, but I think that's because I just don't like The Star Is Born. I don't think there's anything wrong with the direction in that movie, it's just, or his performance. I just don't like the story.
They've used the worst possible picture of him for... It just looks like Steve Jobs. If you look at Bradley Cooper's Wikipedia page, he just... I don't know, he just looks like an accountant dad looking at his kids in a playground, like, half-interestedly. Doesn't he? It's like, that's not a good picture of him.
Oh, God, yeah. Mum hair? Jesus.
Yeah, okay. So shall I cut my hair or shall I just start drinking at 9 a.m? It's a tough choice.
There is a bit of Steve Jobs going on there, isn't there?
A touch of Steve. I wish I, my favorite Leonard Bernstein movement. It's funny you should. Do you know what? It'll lead on so nicely from you talking about Keira Mulligan. I'll talk about a Keira Mulligan film I saw, which is Spaceman, Adam Sandler.
Oh, thank you.
Why'd you say thank you?
Thank you for sacrificing your time. Right. So that I don't have to watch this film.
This film, and for any of you out there who like see it on Netflix and it's recommended to you, and you think, oh, Adam Sandler in a serious role, he's done some good serious roles, you'll not like it. It is not a good film. And I will tell you why at length. So Adam Sandler is a Czech astronaut. And this is set, I think, in the like
typecasting, Jesus.
Late 70s, early 80s. His accent is subtle at best and non-existent at worst. He's on this, there's been this sort of mysterious cloud of dust in space, this purple belt, and the Czech solo mission, just him, never really explained why, it's just one bloke, is on his way out there on this sort of year-long trip, 6 months there, 6 months back, to take a sample of it and find out what it is. And he is a distant man. His wife is Keira Mulligan. She's heavily pregnant back on Earth. And I don't feel the need to spoil the film, but what happens is, and this is in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler, about 6 months into the voyage, when he's having issues with contact, and things are kind of breaking down on his sort of solo ship, he just one day comes out of his bunk and just sees this giant alien spider voiced by our boy Paul Dano, who sort of, I thought it was telepathy, but he actually does move his kind of mouth and talk to him.
Okay.
And he is, Adam Sandler's convinced he's just losing his mind. But this spider's like, no, I am an alien being, and I'm drawn to your loneliness. I've never seen one of your kind this far away from Earth. So I'm just here, almost like you are with a cloud. I'm just a viewer. I just want to know more. I'm just sort of an explorer myself. And up until that point, the film was in first gear. And when that happens, it is the initial response he has to seeing this alien spider is the highlight, because the film is absolutely downhill from then on. Am I okay to spoil this, do you think?
Well, I think as long as we give ample like warning, I don't see why not.
So I'll say skip forward like, you know, 6 or 7 minutes if you want. You don't mind me spoiling this.
I've no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah. Right, so Adam Sandler cannot carry this film. I know people you've seen him in more dramatic roles than I have. But
Uncut Gems, everyone.
Yeah, so the problem with this film is he hasn't got a true black and readable depth to him. What they should have done in this film is cast Ben Foster. That is a man who, with like shining wide eyes, can convey so much. Right, with like no words. But
I mean, cast Ben Foster is something that you just generally just say by every film, really.
By most films, yeah. And his kind of like dry mumble and his, you know, his sheer depth of character would have helped this along. Mm-hmm. But Adam Sandler just looks kind of uninterested in everything. Like when he first bumps into this spider, he kind of doesn't react with shock. He kind of backs away. Goes back into his sleeping tablet, goes back into his bunk, instantly takes a load of these like sleep drops and just thinks, fuck, I need some sleep. And it's quite funny. It's like his response. I'm like, wow, okay, I'm losing my mind. But you realize that there's no, that's all he kind of does. They just end up having these really rambling and interesting conversations where they ask each other questions they wouldn't, just for dramatic effect. And the spider is obsessed with the fact that he has left his wife, his mate, as he keeps calling it, to do this. And he's like, but I have to do this. It's my job. And he's like, but I think you kind of enjoy the loneliness. And then it's just a load of flashbacks of Adam Sandler basically having a slightly abusive father who, you know, he came from nothing. And now he's this sort of famous Czech astronaut. But the real problem is that the so-called heart of the film, the hollow heart of the film, is that his wife wants to leave him while he's on the space mission. And you see her back on Earth, and how, and she's so like, I don't love him. He's really distant, you know, and they keep on having flashbacks to when they very, very first met. And even then it's kind of slightly awkward, but they obviously get on in kind of a, we're two opposites that have attracted kind of way. And it keeps flashing back to that very first meeting. And every time it flashes back to anything beyond it, they're clearly just in a shit marriage. Like, they have nothing in common. So you think, well, you probably should separate, you know, because aside from that first romanticized meeting at a costume party, you've just been drifting apart ever since, haven't you? And so when the film reaches its sort of climax, and the climax of the film is basically Adam Sandler realizing, I should probably spend more time with my wife. And you think, this film hasn't earned that, and that's such a shit thing to earn anyway. There are scenes in this film where they talk.
He's probably in the wrong job, really, isn't he, for spending time with his family?
There are scenes in this film where they have these stilted conversations over this radio, which is like this sort of, you know, space radio, and they're not talking like humans. They're talking like they're taking it in turns to recite Bon Jovi lyrics to each other. I thought you'd never call. I thought you wouldn't pick up. And you're like, that's not how a couple talks to each other in their 50s. Yeah. He's obviously in his 40s or 50s. And secondly, that's not how you would talk after being apart for this long, knowing you need to mend your marriage. So nothing rings true. Everything's romanticized. There's a flashback where Keira Mulligan just says she's leaving him and she's going to go to this like commune in the woods. And she goes outside to look up at this like sort of purple belt that obviously Adam Sandler's heading to in his spacecraft. And there's just another pregnant woman up there. And she looks up and says, I wouldn't want to be up there. Imagine your husband being up there. And you're like, what? That's a very specific thing to say, isn't it? When you meet someone for the first time that completely clicks in with their personal life. It's just terrible. It's absolutely terrible. The way that the relationship with him and the spider is terrible. The conversation. The best thing about it is Paul Dano's delivery. I reckon if you separated all of Paul Dano's delivery in this film and put it as an ASMR tape, it would work really well. And I was watching this, and when I clicked on Paul Dano's voice, who I really like, I was thinking, this kind of reminds me of Swiss Army Man in a way, because in that, I don't know how much you liked Swiss Army Man. I really liked it, right? So without spoiling anything, the main the way the narrative works in Swiss Army Man is it's basically someone's fantasy. And at the end, they are brought down hard to earth and you realize the incredibly sad, tragically human reality of the situation they're actually in. And it's like, ooh, and it really worked for me. And I got really like, wow, caught up in it, thinking that's really strong stuff. And I really like that. This film kind of tries to do the same thing, but it's like, because you're just thinking, well, you're just not a good husband and you're like a really bland man. And she just is better off without you, really. And it's just Adam Sandler not being able to get the depth of character to carry the main middle part of the film. And then him having boring. How can you have boring conversations with an alien spider? You'd be like, the moment the door opened, I saw it, I'd be like, wow, my God, you're an alien spider that's like 20 feet big. How'd you wipe your ass? How'd you shag? What's your favorite? What do you drink? Are you battered? Am I battered?
Can we how get many eyes have you got?
How many fingers am I holding up? it just felt like a load of missed opportunities. And when it ended, halfway through, I looked at Faye and I got the sense that she would be quite happy for me to turn it off. But I thought, this film is such a car crash. I want to see how it ends because it cannot end well. With whoever wrote the script, honestly, the teenage breakup poetry and the bloody, like, over-romanticized mid-80s hair metal they must have listened to get their ideas. And I remember reading afterwards, because I was obsessed with it for a few days. Like, how can it be so bad? How can that film be so misguided? And when I went online, it's like, it spent 3 years in post-production. And I thought, yeah, they were trying to get something out of it, is what they were trying to do.
Anything. Oh, my God. Mm.
It's dreadful. It's almost like I was kind of thinking, how can it be this boring? And it would be, and things would happen, and I would literally audibly groan. Like, they'd look out of the window, him and this spider, at like this belt that they're approaching or whatever, and then Adam Sandler would say, like, oh, what is it? Is it? And then the spider would say, it's everything. And there would be a gap, and I would say, it's nothing. And then he would actually say, it's nothing. It's the end. And I would say, is it the beginning as well, alien spider? And he would be, but it's also the beginning. And I think, my fucking God, who wrote this script? It's unbelievable. It's one of the worst films I've ever seen. And I... like, it's astonishing. It's so, like, misguided and just crap and cheesy and obvious and telegraphed in every possible aspect that it's unbelievable. It's so bad.
Mm. So I'm just thinking of, like, Adam Sandler in this film. Like, because when I think of Adam Sandler's good performances, like serious performances, like Punch Drunk Love or
Spanglish
Gems, then they're quite... neurotic and high energy, not as high energy, but definitely neurotic. Like, they're not very internalized, put it that way. So, like, this to me seems like you said, like, you need an actor who can convey a lot with very little, and I'm not sure that Adam Sandler is that man.
There's key scenes in this film where something like extremely bad is happening, and Adam Sandler, without spoiling anything further, doesn't want it to happen. And he's there and he's going, no, no, no. Mm-hmm. And you think, this isn't the film for you, Adam, I'm afraid. And there's a scene at the start where he is sort of projecting a video back to Earth, and like Czech school children are asking him questions. Czech school children who have more convincing accents than he does, and they're like saying, oh, what are you lonely in space? And he's like, no, I'm not lonely. And and they're like, oh, now we're gonna go to whatever his name is, Jacob Prochaska in space. And it gets to Adam Sandler, you think, this feels like a weird Saturday Night Live sketch, because he's so clearly miscast. It's kind of, I guess, honorable that he's like trying to do something different, but he is, like you say, he's not an internalized actor. There's no, it's like he can't do it, and he very clearly can't do it. It's just, yeah, it's just terrible.
Oh dear, oh dear. Yeah, I had high hopes for this film about a spaceman with a giant spider in it. What could go wrong?
The answer is generally everything. And I know you have a problem with cheesy music as well. You would have a whale of a time with this. Some of it is like, some of the music's really good. Like this sort of, it's this sort of ambient, gentle. And at the start, I thought this kind of ambient, eerie synth. I was like, here we go. But then, of course, it just turns cheesy. And it's everything about it is, every time it goes to any character, anytime any lines are delivered, anytime it goes back to him in space, it's like, how can you fuck up someone stuck in a spacecraft within a giant alien spider? You know, like...
I know.
It
feels like a film that should have had no dialogue except for the just conversations with the alien to really make it ambiguous.
Hearing like one half of conversations, when he does talk back to Earth, and not have a load of like silly stuff going on. But he's supposed to be this. The last thing I'll say before I move on, because you're done with your films now, aren't you?
I am.
I've got two more to do, but there are scenes, right, where he is like a born explorer. Like, the whole point of the film, working against his own internal logic, is that he is like this professional who finds solace and peace by himself in space, doing a job and being good at that job, right? So when he meets an alien being for the first time, which is kind of what at the back of his mind he's, I guess, always been like hoping for, to truly find something new. The whole reason he's going to this purple light in space, to experience something for the first time. He meets this alien spider, and he's conversing with it. And the moment it asks him about his wife, he sulks and slams the door and goes to bed. And you think, that's just another character. That is, that's just forced drama in this like shades. Like, by all means, be unable to explain yourself, but don't extend the film by slowly opening up about your wife, where there's so much more at stake than that. You know, there's so much more. Yeah. It's like you're focusing on
it's
the
very reductive, isn't it? About
like, and if you think about it, if you replace that alien spider with just another astronaut, the same thing would have happened, wouldn't it? I don't want to talk about it. Let's just go about it. It's the same thing, just replaced with a spider. It's crap.
I think if you went into deep space and did, you know, find alien life, you'd probably have other things to think about than. It sounds harsh, but you probably wouldn't be thinking about your life back home and stuff. I think you'd totally transform your whole personality, your whole perspective on everything. Like, it doesn't seem like it would suddenly make you very internalized and introspective. But yeah, there you go. It's just bad writing, you know.
It's very bad. It's a very, very bad film.
Okay.
Thank you again. Thank you for saving me over a minute. So I watched two other films. One of the next film I watched was called My Son, which is a 2021 Christian Carrion film. I think he's a French director, and it's based on a film he has already done in French. So let me just click on this, because I was reading, but like I said, this is a little. So he's a French director. He made a film called, oh God, let me just get this right now. Oh, Mon Garçon, so My Son, or My Boy, or whatever, in 2017. And he remade it in English using the same style, which I'll go into in a minute, in 2021. Right. So this is a film that stars James McAvoy and Claire Foy. And it's. Right. I'll talk about the. I think the best thing to do is talk about the premise first and then the style after that, okay. Right? So the premise is James McAvoy, who is an actor that I really, really like, plays Edmund Murray, and he's kind of a distant father. He works on, it's kind of hinted at that he works away for like very long stretches of time on like oil rigs and stuff it's intimated there's sort of how's the best way to say it, sort of morally dubious countries at war, if you know what I mean. So like it's a very dangerous job, very well paid, and he is just away for long stretches of time, and he can't really talk about it. It's all filmed in Scotland. Most of the cast are Scottish. He's pulled back to Scotland because his son, who is like seven, called Ethan, is in a holiday camp, a shit holiday camp it looks like, and he's just disappeared. At one in the morning, they think he's been abducted. And Claire Foy plays his estranged wife. So the whole film is them, mostly him, in kind of handheld cam close-up, quite intense, very little music, you know, hard drama, what has happened to my son. And I didn't know this when I watched the film, which may have been to its great benefit, because I really did like it in some aspects. Christian Carrion, the way he's done this and the way he did the original French film Mon Garçon, is everyone in the film knew the script apart from James McAvoy. So he knew his character's backstory, but and I'm assuming they did multiple takes, because otherwise it would be completely intelligible. He improvises his responses throughout the whole film.
Okay.
So what that means is, without spoiling it, because I think you should watch this, because I'm really intrigued what you will take from this. This was on Netflix, knowing that, because I didn't know it when I watched it. What I took from it is, when we're watching it, it's a really naturalistic performance. Like he, because he's reacting to the moment, I guess, obviously there are multiple takes, but when someone says something to him and the camera's always on his face, because you can see his internal logic ticking over, it's almost like he does come across as like someone who he could be in a relationship with Claire Foy that could have crumbled because of his job, and he probably is an absent father because of his dedication to it, and all of that kind of, you can see it in his face, if that makes sense. there were like really, there were really nice scenes where it's set over like a few days, and it, obviously the longer his son is missing, the more intense it gets, and the more unlikely it is they'll find him. And some of the sequences are really tense, and because it's all a bit of a free for all in terms of him, he does odd things that really fit with the character. Like there's a moment where there are a few moments where like the sheer tiredness and like the stress shows on him, and he's like washes his face in a stream, or he'll like in the middle of a key scene he will like lean against a wall and just have a few seconds to kind of gather himself because of what he's about to do or about to go into. And I really liked all of that. I thought, oh, this is right up my street. The other side of that issue though is that because he is making up and improvising his way through the script, there are a lot of dead ends and a lot of things that are brought up that aren't followed through or kind of contradict the story itself. And they become more and more apparent as that happens. Like, for example, there's a scene at the start where he goes over to visit his estranged wife and her partner. And her partner is an architect. And the partner says, oh, you know, Claire Foy's in bed. She took a couple of Valium. She just needed to sleep. She's been so stressed since this all happened. And James McAvoy instantly kicks off saying like, oh, she's never taken a pill in her life. Why is she taking it now? And instantly distrusts him. And I thought, well, if your son's gone missing and you're at the end of your tether, you might need a break. And you might at that point, at that extreme point in your life, take a Valium. You know, it's not that ridiculous, is it? But even more kind of jarring is a few minutes later, this new partner of Claire Foy's character starts just showing him blueprints of a house he intends to build. And he's like, oh yeah, we're going to live out in the lake and all this sort of stuff. And James McAvoy says, are you kidding me? And the guy's like, what are you talking about? He says, this house, there's no bedroom for my son. And he just beats him up. And I thought, well, if he took that to the police and said, this kid has gone missing, and this person who I'm very suspicious of, who's just come into my life, is planning on building a house without a child's bedroom when he's basically going to be taking, you know what I mean? That's ridiculous, isn't it? It's a ridiculous concept, but it's never followed up on, never mentioned again. And that happens too many times for the film to be smooth. It's worth watching for his performance. It's because it's great. It really is great. And really because you don't know what he's going to do. There are certain situations he gets hold of certain people, and in certain situations, and you think, how is this going to resolve itself? And it's usually quite satisfying and quite full on. But it's also feels really understated. Like, because he's just a bloke, when he finds, I try not to spoil it, but when he finds like a certain building he needs to go into, the fact that it shows him circling it, and the fact that he's kind of panicked and he's not equipped to deal with what might be in there, it kind of, especially because you and I are like fathers of young children, it kind of makes you shiver a bit. Like, you don't know what you're going into. You don't know what you're going to see, you know, and that really connected with me. But I kind of wish it, but maybe if he did know the script and it was a more traditional film, maybe the little elements that I really enjoyed wouldn't be in there. So it's an interesting film.
It's an intriguing concept, yeah. Like, and the fact that, you know, he doesn't want to go into the building or whatever, then he genuinely wouldn't want to go in the building because he doesn't know what he's going to find in real life, I guess. So,
because he doesn't kind of know what's going to happen. So maybe that element of like, am I just going to get jumped?
This is going to be like a dead child in there.
There's just so many good scenes where he's like driving through these like rural Scottish roads in like a Land Rover, and it's just on his face in profile, and you can just see he's just like a mixture of like panic and worried and just extremely tired and like not. And knowing what's, I really like that aspect of it. We enjoyed the film, and afterwards I was like, oh wow, Faye, you know, this was all done in this kind of way. You didn't know the script, and it's like, oh, that makes sense. But also, it does at least excuse some of the more extraneous points. You're like, why is he said that, or why are they doing this? So yeah, My Son on Netflix. Quite enjoyed it. And my last film is Nocebo, which is a Filipino-Irish psychological thriller.
Of course it is.
There's a load of names I don't know. Directed by Lorcan Finnegan, from a screenplay by Garrett Shanley. Don't know if any of those ring any bells with you, Rupert.
No.
So this stars Eva Green and Mark Strong as, this is a two-minuter. Eva Green and Mark Strong as she's a fashion designer, and at the start of the film you see that she's got this this fashion show, and she goes backstage and she sees this dog, and it's like a really mangy, it looks almost like a zombie dog, and it's very bad CG, and it stands in front of it and just starts to shake and shake, and all these ticks fly off it. One of them lands and burrows into her neck, and it kind of fast forwards a few years, and she's just a complete shadow of her former self. Like, she's just like a real mess, an absolute mess of a person, having all these like awful dreams and having to have oxygen in the evenings and stuff. Mark Strong is a marketing executive who's an extremely attractive husband who's in the bar. Mark Strong is in the bar with his voice. My God, if he whispered me to sleep, I'd never be soft again. And he, so he's her husband, and they've got this daughter, and she, it's a really bizarre start, because this Filipino lady just knocks on her door, and she's like, hello. And it's like, what? And she says, oh, you called me, you needed help, you called me from the Philippines to come and help you with all the problems you're having. And she just assumes that she's done it in one of her like hallucinations. Okay. She's like, oh, okay. And it's really funny, because Mark Strong comes over and he's like, oh, hello, Filipino lady. What's happening? And it's quite a funny scene. Anyway, so the point is that this Diana, this Filipino woman, is there, and it's like, is she helping her? Is she hindering her? Why is she really there? What's going on? And I kind of guessed the entire plot from the first meeting, because I thought, you're a fashion designer, right, who works with like high street markets, and she's a Filipino woman who has an axe to grind against you personally. It doesn't take much of a leap, does it, to work out what the link is?
Right.
If you're with me. And that's literally the film. It boils down to like that. It's interesting. It's really great in terms of the like some of the rituals and the intensity, and the fact it's basically all filmed in a house. But it's a very, very basic, like very clearly sort of telegraphed thriller.
Sounds almost like a kind of 90s thriller.
Yeah, it really does, which is probably why I didn't mind it, and that's kind of how I describe it. I didn't mind it. It's nothing, you know, amazing. But
sums up most of 90s cinema, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. I've seen, what was that one with Ashley Judd and Morgan Freeman? Kiss the Girls as well.
Yeah.
And
what was the one with Ashley Judd where she keeps drinking wine and passing out?
Oh, not Murder by Numbers. You have to... Oh, God, hang on. I'll tell you now. It's the same bottle of wine over weeks. And it's like that wine, I know red wine goes bonky after, what, a day of being opened? Well, have you got it? I can't find here on Wikipedia for some reason. There we go. I'll tell you the moment I see the title.
Yeah.
Is it
a one-word thing?
I think it's a one-word thing. Twisted.
Twisted, right. Okay.
Yeah. Twisted. That film's very good, Rupert. So yeah, Mark Strong in this film made the easiest paycheck he's ever earned, because all he does is walk into rooms and say one of three things, and it's either to the Filipino woman, I don't trust you. He walks in and says to his wife, you sure you're all right? Or he walks into his daughter and says, are you lying? And that's it. And that's it. He literally just walks in the room, says a couple of words, frowns, and then goes back out regardless of the context. He must have been laughing when he got his paycheck for this film. It's okay. If you like 90s thrillers, you'll watch this with a, you know, couple of drinks and think, yeah, it was all right. And then you'll never think about it again. And with a name like Nocebo, if someone says, what was that film you watched last week? You'd also go, oh, I can't remember. And you'll never think about it ever again.
Why Nocebo?
Apparently it's a term for you get like a placebo.
Yeah.
A Nocebo is like either a placebo or another sort of medicine that actually has like a negative effect.
Okay. So a placebo is like it's a nothing, and so it's a psychological thing. So a nocebo would actually have a negative effect
on you. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, the film is just like you say, if that was released in 1999 with Ashley Judd and Morgan Freeman, Andy Garcia, I'd be like, yeah, there we go. I'll chat that on. I got to look at Mark Strong for a bit. I always want to call him Andrew Strong, but that's the singer from The Commitments, so I will never make that mistake ever again.
No, don't.
So we now move on to, well, first of all, before we do the Arkansas, what is your film of the week?
Oh, yeah. I think it's got to be Maestro.
Oh, nice. Okay. That makes sense. That was the one out of all you said that I was twitching to watch.
Yeah. You should watch that. I think you'd like it.
I haven't got much choice, really. If you think about the films I watched right this period, Wolfman of the Lost City, Who's Harry Crumb, Wrongfully Accused, No Sebo, Spaceman, and My Son. So yeah, although it has its flaws, My Son was an interesting film.
Yeah,
it's one of those films that I'm intrigued what other people will think when they watch it.
Mm.
So I wonder if
I'll have a different experience knowing that it's an improvised performance. And...
So yeah, My Son on Netflix. And if you want to watch it and let us know what you thought, it's the men who talk at outlook.com, not the men who really talk at gmail.org. Right then, I apologize in advance for Utah Smith because I have not prepped his Arkansas. I promise I'll do it next time. Although the first Arkansas he sent me, even though it was Mickey Rourke to Sam Elliott, he sent me one that was just John Voight to Peter Stormare. And I was like, what? So I'll read those out next time. I do apologize, Utah. Do you want to do yours first and we'll see how the audience stuck up with you?
Yes, I think I did pretty well on this one.
Okay.
Because Sam Elliott is in Tombstone with Powers Booth, who's in Sin City 2 with Mickey Rourke, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but I think.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I think that's a two-stepper.
That's a two-stepper. So let's see how everyone else did. So David, and I do apologize if I butcher your surname, David Chokovitz said Mickey Rourke was in Iron Man 2 with Stan Lee. Stan Lee was in Hulk with Sam Elliott. So that's another two-stepper.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Welband said, I'm going The Wrestler. Mickey Rourke's in The Wrestler with Marisa Tomei, who was in My Cousin Vinny with Ralph Macchio. Thank you, Ed. Who was in The Outsiders with Patrick Swayze in The Roadhouse. Oh, sorry, Outsiders with Swayze, who was in Roadhouse with Sam Elliott. So, Wrestler's like Marisa Tomei. My Cousin Vinny.
That's probably the most interesting.
That's a four-stepper. Transvaal said Sam Elliott is in The Hulk with Stan Lee, who was in Iron Man 2 with Mickey Rourke.
Okay.
Same as Dave. And Waxy O'Connor says Mickey Rourke is in Iron Man 2 with about 100 different people who are also in Iron Man 1 with Jeff Bridges, who is in The Big Lebowski with Sam Elliott. And our occasional co-host and constant lover, Laszlo Bucket, said, hey, babes, here's a tour for you. Mickey Rourke was in Sin City with Powers Booth, who was in Tombstone with Sam Elliott.
Yes.
That's two mentions of Tombstone.
Laszlo. Yeah.
So it's a two-step. Let me highlight. What was yours again? Let me just put yours down. So
Sam is in Tombstone with Powers Booth, who's in Sin City 2 with Mickey Rourke. I don't know. It's Sin City, well, one of the Sin City films.
That's fine. Yeah, cool. Because I'm gonna put these on social media.
Keeping score? Okay.
Do you want to start keeping score? You feeling
not
that
in the slightest? No.
I have been keeping score, and it's
right.
It's 400-0 to the audience. So you need to really
do that, don't I?
You need to buck your ideas up, quite frankly. So what's okay. the what are we gonna set as the AZ for next time?
Annette Bening. She can be one of them.
Oh, I want to say James McAvoy.
You can say.
Oh no! I won't say that because he will go straight to the fucking Marvel, and I'm not having that.
Oh yeah. Dodge the Marvel.
Annette Bening to John Candy.
I don't know why I find that so funny.
I would say like
it's to because me. I'm thinking because usually the first thing I think of is like oh my were they in a film together? You know, there's always a risk. But I think there's no fucking way John Candy were ever in a movie together. Like, they could have been. Well, I suppose actually, they, you know, they're a similar generation. I mean, they could have been romantic comedy.
Yeah, romantic leads in a film, of course. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, especially isn't it being stunningly beautiful back in their day, and then you got John Candy, who's nothing but
who can smoke and eat a hot dog at the same time. So yeah, no, love you obviously incredibly as always. It's been a good one today. Actually, there's I do apologize to Utah Smith because I missed off one of his not missed I skipped one of his sort of bits. Which I'll do next time, and that's I also criminal. Missed off his Arkansas, so that was just my poor planning. There was a lot to remember, but
we've got a fun-packed episode next time then, because we've got all that content, plus we've got American Ninja 1 to 5. Are there any more than 5?
Whoa, please hang on. What did it? 5.
Yeah.
I thought there was 4.
No, there is a 5.
Oh my God!
Oh my goodness!
So am I right in saying this?
I think it might have been called something different in America because I think they're trying to reboot it, maybe.
I thought it was American Ninja 1 and 2, Dudikoff, 3, Andrew Bradley, 4, Dudikoff and Bradley.
No, there is American Ninja 5, Bradley again. I haven't watched this one yet. In 93. Yeah, it was called. It was called American Dragons in the US, I think.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The film was not originally intended to be part of the franchise. It hasn't stopped them. The other films, to be honest, in terms of continuity. Fifth one's got Pat Morita in it as well. So.
Do you remember that film he watched where he literally just disappeared, like actual magic, just disappeared in a cloud of smoke? Whichever film one of us watched that was.
Whoa, Pat Morita, are we talking about?
Yeah, he drops his son off at like a dojo and says, anyway, I've got to go. And he literally disappears in a cloud of smoke. And I was watching the film, God. And I said, he's in the center of a gym in the middle of a basketball court. Like, that's magic, that is. Like, he disappeared.
Yeah.
So
that's an issue. There is a magic issue with American Ninja as well. But anyway, so, okay, I can't wait to talk about these. So good.
I love you.
Love you. They're similar generation. I mean, they could have been romantic comedy.
Yeah, romantic leads in a film, of course. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, especially isn't it being stunningly beautiful back in their day, and then you got John Candy, who's nothing but
who can smoke and eat a hot dog at the same time. So yeah, no, love you obviously incredibly as always. It's been a good one today, actually. There's I do apologize to Utah Smith because I missed off one of his not missed I skipped one of his sort of bits, which I'll do next time, and that's I also criminal. Missed off his Arkansas, so that was just my poor planning. There was a lot to remember, but
we've got a fun-packed episode next time then, because we've got all that content, plus we've got American Ninja 1 to 5. Are there any more than 5?
Whoa, please, hang on. What did it? 5.
Yeah.
I thought there was 4.
No, there is a 5.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
So am I right in saying this?
I think it might have been called something different in America because I think they're trying to reboot it, maybe.
I thought it was American Ninja 1 and 2, Dudikoff, 3, Andrew Bradley, 4, Dudikoff and Bradley.
No, there is American Ninja 5, Bradley again. I haven't watched this one yet. In 93. Yeah, it was called American Dragons in the US, I think.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The film was not originally intended to be part of the franchise. It hasn't stopped them. The other films, to be honest, in terms of continuity. Fifth one's got Pat Morita in it as well, so.
Do you remember that film he watched where he literally just disappeared, like actual magic, just disappeared in a cloud of smoke? Whichever film one of us watched that was.
Whoa, Pat Morita, are we talking about?
Yeah, he drops his son off at like a dojo and says, anyway, I've got to go. And he literally disappears in a cloud of smoke. And I was watching the film, God. And I said, he's in the center of a gym in the middle of a basketball court. Like, that's magic, that is. Like, he disappeared.
Yeah.
So
that's an issue. There is a magic issue with American Ninja as well. But anyway, so, okay, I can't wait to talk about these. So good.
I love you.
Love you.
Hey, it's Tia Carrere, and you're listening to Kino Kingdom with Britt and Rupert. Party on, guys.